Jay Beam and Jay Savitri, everyone. I'm Thinmoy Soundarajan, and this is the podcast Cast in the United States with First Post. Today's episode is an exploration of caste and policy. Joining us is Benson Neethapudi of Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. He is a longtime thinker about caste, public policy, and development, and we are so excited to have him join us. Welcome, Benson.
Jay Beam, friends.
So Benson, I wanted to start off with an initial question about policy. You are one of the few Dalits who is publicly out in this field, and a lot of Suvarnas who end up being Indian leaders of civil society for multinationals or the government get training in American institutions like Columbia. Can you share with our listeners what is it like to be inside one of these institutions and how prevalent is caste?
Mike, to begin with, I think to set the framework, it needs to be understood that public policy, you call it civil society or like international affairs, development sector, the international non-governmental agencies. This whole sector as such represents the pinnacle of privilege. It is actually a mirror of like how caste works in the sense who gets to be in these spaces. At least like when we talk about like STEM or like, you know, computer, like the IT industry or the more mainstream corporate industry, there is an opportunity to make wealth and there are people like everybody who can aspire to be in these places. But when you look at public policy, there is not a lot of wealth creation, but there's a lot of like intellectual capital and like hegemony on knowledge production and how you influence policy. And who gets to be in these places is based on like where your position in the society is. When I was growing up, the only understanding of public policy was, in a very layman terms, those who do good for other people. These used to be like, you know, really wealthy people or like who had like their own family foundations who would come and like give up a prize in a school for like, you know, poor children. And when you look at like who are these people, then, you know, it's very easy to identify that they're predominantly upper caste who get to be in these places by virtue of their previous wealth. And it's no surprise that like when I'm here, like, you know, at an Ivy League university and who my classmates are, and it's a similar reflection. There are smart people. They are like very passionate. For me, this is personal. This is beyond passion, right? This is personal for us because the work which we do as policymakers, that will impact my siblings or my cousins or people I know personally. So that is why for me, policy is very personal. My experience in this field has been like, you know, that folks will talk about caste. Like I've heard like from people in my program that say they'll talk about caste, but they will not talk about caste to me directly. And that happens across when in mainstream public policy, when they talk about India, all the work is about like, you know, the poor people, the marginalized, the discriminated, the unprivileged. But then nobody goes beyond and asks the questions like, who are these people you're talking about? Right? In the American context, when we talk about urban policy or health policy, if you don't factor race as a dimension, your policy will be limited. Your policy will be unidimensional. Likewise, when we think about policy in terms of India, like when you don't factor in caste, it will be limited. So that is the challenge of only like the upper caste folks having a hegemony in, or like, you know, being in the leadership of the sector. Like, you know, again, my experience have been like that, you know, there are folks who will come up to me straight up and say, my grandfather allowed the untouchables in my village to use their tank to drink water. So that'll be one end of the spectrum. And the other one is people coming and say, you know, we should talk more about caste, or like, you know, folks who have been against reservation till like a year ago, who have now read Annihilation of Caste. And now they say, they say Jay Beam, and now we have to accept that they're comrades. So that is the like the spectrum of folks you kind of meet in this sector. So their intentions might be good, but their learning, their lived experiences are very unidimensional. So they might be innocent, but the impact of all of this is just as harmful.
Can you describe one instance of casteism that really challenged you?
The thing is, as I mentioned, the folks who come into this space are like, you know, educated in the West. They know that caste exists while they may not speak about it, but they also know political correctness. So often what happens is in this space, this is like your constant microaggressions. So that is how caste can manifest. It happens even without speaking. This is the refined casteism where you can actually see this. And of course, the work which you do and the policies you implement have direct implications. But like in a day-to-day basis, there's a lot of like unspoken manners in which caste manifests itself.
Can you maybe, is there like an example of one of those unspoken manners that you could share with our audience? Because my feeling is that in talking with people don't even know that they're being castis because it's such a part of their behavioral repertoire, right? So I'm just wondering if there's like a specific detail you can think of that could help paint that picture for our audience.
Of course. I wanted to give this premise, but then I actually like have a couple of incidents. This is like me being a policy person, giving the putting out the non-disclosure policy and not like making it about one person. If I think of like a particular incident, I would say, I remember like years ago, I was at an education conference where in India, which had like the who's of the education policy space, former bureaucrats, former education secretary, and like in the philanthropy space, everybody was there. And it was very engaging. And this is a group of folks who really like want to influence the way Indian education reaches out to the students in this space. And in one of the sessions, one of the speakers, a very well-known figure in the education space, they were talking about their engagement with the government. And they mentioned like in passing and as part of the conversations about like, you know, talking about how some of the government bureaucrats are so fantastic. They mentioned about one of the previous secretary for education, which is a top bureaucrat for education in India. They were mentioning how they were so organized and so perfect, just like the Brahmin they were. So the entire room just like nodded and they smiled, but nobody found that upsetting. And I was like, is this okay? This is not okay. This person, like the speaker, in their like framework of the conversation, the bureaucrat was this very organized, well-meaning and perfect person because they were Brahmin. While what they said was just like a footnote in the conversation or just the way they were explaining it, that talks a lot to like how caste is normalized. And when you're not from that space, when you sit there, you think like, okay, I'm not a Brahmin, so like, will they associate what they think of my caste to be my characteristics or the nature of the work or the output I put out? So these kind of incidences, they kind of like trigger a lot of introspection, and you ask these tougher questions. And even before that, I remember like as I was I went to an event in Delhi where there was a few big name donors of an organization that were there, and where I was speaking about the work I did, and we spoke about how I told my story and how I ended up being at that place, or like my interaction with caste and like how I see it. And even all this, everything I said was from a very professional and a policy perspective. It was good enough. Like one of in the audience was the then ambassador of America to India. They were there in that audience and they were the key speaker. So after I was done, they spoke and they actually gave a shout out and said like, hey, thank you for talking about your journey and so and so. But later in the dinner section, one of the like the donors, like a big name donor who was there, they came up to me and they said like, do not use the word Dalit. They just said that in my ear and then they walked away.
Well, unbelievable. That's terrible, Benson. So what did you do?
I was startled. Like, I was like, okay. There was no context of what they said. They were like, you know, they patted my back. They appreciated like, you know, what I did. And they just said like, do not use the word Dalit. And then they left. So when we talk about like intersectionality or like, you know, like today we're talking about intersectionality in our work, we're talking about like justice and development, socioeconomic justice, or like what is the path forward? But if you're not even willing to acknowledge, like, you know, in India, caste to be one of the central reasons for intergenerational poverty, like, you know, you're a big donor, you work in a development sector, you're willing to put your money, but you're not willing to acknowledge that caste plays a central role in how poverty functions in India, then where is that intersectionality?
I think that's a very important point to really bring up, because again, I think that what's really critical, and this is like a theme that keeps coming up across all of our episodes, is that the discussion of caste is almost always relegated when dominant caste people are in charge of the conversation to the consequences of caste. So we're going to deal with, you know, the constant underdevelopment of marginalized communities. And then there's like all these studies about like how these communities are struggling and what are some of their internal deficiencies. Mm-hmm. There's never that same aggressive lens to the dominant caste networks that actually benefit from our chronic underdevelopment, and that there could actually be many positive policy visions that address actually people of caste privilege, as opposed to simply looking as if caste discrimination and constant marginalization because of the basis of caste has no point of origin, has no people that benefit, but there's just simply always going to be hundreds of millions of people that are impacted by the violence and the atrocity and the systemic exclusion. And I think that's why, Benson, I think it's so important to hear some of your insights about how closed these policy spaces are. Because incubators like the Columbia SIPA School or Harvard Kennedy School that have these like bright and shiny savannas that are set up to be the next administrators, you know, grant officers and people who represent India at the UN level, these are all people that actually have no lived experience of hundreds of millions of people that they're supposed to represent. And even worse, they do not know their own internal biases. And that's why I think it's really important to think about, like, how are you and, you know, some of your other colleagues that are like a new generation of Dalits in this realm changing the game and thinking about how things could be done differently?
I'll give you a couple of examples of like how I think about policy in terms of like, you know, caste and caste marginalization. I know recently India's NEP, the National Education Policy, came into effect, and there was a lot of conversation around it. But just before that, a prominent Indian author, eminent thinker, who also happens to be like a Harvard graduate and a former CEO, they had an analysis piece like talking about the need to privatize education. And one of the key premises for the arguments was that 47% of India's children are in private schools. So this translates to roughly about 120 million students, and that makes India the third largest private school system in the world. Again, in India, when you talk private schools, like, you know, is it fully private? Is it government-aided private? There's so many questions, but even without going into that minutiae, taking it the face value, when you say 47% of Indian children are in private schools, and that is how a policy is being explained, what you're not talking about is that 53% of remaining Indian students still go to public schools. So that is the kind of paradigm shift we need to think through. And when you say these 53% of the students are still going to public schools, we need to think, who are these 53%? I remember doing like an after-school intervention at a government school in rural Andhra Pradesh. Again, this is like one example, so I cannot explain it with statistical significance. So we were doing this after-school intervention program for 10th grade students in a government school. There were 26 students. And out of these 26 students, 12 SC, which is scheduled caste, the legal classification for Dalits. Another 12 were BC or OBC, which translates as backward caste. And only 2 students were OC, which is a term for upper caste. At public school, that is a reflection of like the realities of public school. So today, if you want to like push for private education, and again, there is a lot of good in private education, not denying that. And there are problems with public education. You need to understand who is accessing these spaces. 47% of Indian children are going to private schools, so we need to work on it. And that is great. But what about the remaining 53%? Who are these remaining 53%? And how will they be impacted? In the same school where I did this after-school intervention program, one of the teachers was joking, like in Telugu, they were saying that oka plate, oka slate. That means the students come to the class with a plate and a slate, which means that most of them actually come because of the midday meal program. So now as a policy person, like when you think of it, you have to ask yourself, like, you know, okay, now, yeah, we have to focus on private education because more students will benefit, or like, you know, public schools are failing. But we are not doing the work as to why public schools are failing, because those who go to these public schools, you're not exploring the reasons why they're going there. And that is the kind of like, you know, work that needs to be done going forward. Even today, after the NEP came up, the National Education Policy in India came up, folks, but like most of the debates were like, the policy recommends that the primary education be in the mother tongue. And actually, now that I'm in this policy space and I do a lot of this reading in a particular education policy, yes, there is evidence that you know, when you learn in your mother tongue, you learn better. But that works well in the framework when learning is merely an, you know, intellectual pursuit or an academic endeavor. But for the vast majority of people, especially like, you know, Dalits, Adivasis, and Bahujans, like the lower caste people in India, education is not just an academic endeavor. It is a driver for social mobility, right? We are trying to use this to like, you know, get out of the rut we are always stuck in. So like learning in mother tongue definitely like has an advantage. But like, do we have an economy that will allow those who studied in their mother tongue to actually have like jobs or like a future employment. If you have the wealth, which has like in India's context, only often happens to be divided disproportionately between the upper caste, then you can, you know, engage in, let's say, private English education or other, and which can help you to get into these positions of jobs and like the future you aspire for. But what about the other people, like, you know, the remaining, the vast majority who still use public education and who have no access to English and the economy, which is tied to that language? It is not that learning mother tongue is a challenge. It's just that what is the outcome? Like, you know, is there a job opportunity waiting for me? Can I be an IT engineer who works predominantly in a Telugu-based environment? So that is the questions we need to ask. And as a policy person, these are the kind of questions I would want to be explored further and built research on, because every time, you know, there is now enough research to say that 47% of Indian children are going to private schools. But when are we going to do the research to talk to the remaining 53%?
Well, and I think, Benson, that really brings up this other core point, which is that we need to be designing programs for the most vulnerable by people who are from those communities. Because at a core level, you know, everything that you talked about was actually very true for my dad's story. Like, you know, his mother put her five children through school. And one of the main reasons was that they could guarantee them a meal when she and her husband couldn't afford a meal for them. And they all excelled, you know, despite like all of the circumstances that happened. But, you know, the idea that, you know, when you have so many children from caste oppressed backgrounds learning in their mother tongue, and then if they are able to get to higher education through reservation, they are actually having to be in some of the most competitive environments and also learning English for this at the same time in very high competencies. So there's not even really a process of equity that reservation currently as it's structured really creates. And I think one of the things that I always think about with policy conversations is that, you know, there is a professor in the United States, Lonnie Guinier, who, you know, did a lot of work in terms of equity and education and civil rights law. And, you know, she was like one of the thinkers I really looked to. And when I was talking to folks about affirmative action in the United States, there was one thing where they said, like, you know, some programs in affirmative action focus only on access. But what we really want to think about is what success looks like. And that's that, you know, getting people into the door is only half of the problem. There's all the other structural equity things that you have to really build around that could include language classes, coaching, support for trauma, particularly because if you have people coming from atrocity prone areas, what does that mean to, like, you know, for example, with my dad went to school for the grandson of the Gounders who actually tortured his village. And he had to keep his mouth utterly shut. He couldn't speak about the violence, but imagine having to sit next to that person. Imagine having to be across from them in the mess. And you can't say a word, because these people can then immediately cut you out of the cycle of your career. Because what you said is absolutely correct, is that this is not just a purely, like, you know, exercise of building our brains. All of our students that go to school are there desperately to pull themselves out of poverty and to make a generational change for their family line. So that kind of discourse in educational policy is never really talked about when you're in dominant caste policy spaces. And I think these are the kinds of pains and insights that I see in many Dalit policy people hold in their hearts. But we have to basically create policy on the side. We have to work around dominant caste, you know, grant officers or bureaucrats who, you know, say J Beam to your face, but actually don't have a single bit of the knowledge they need to do to administer for millions of people that are vulnerable to their whims, really. And I think that really goes to, like, the structural power of caste in this space, is that while caste is not mentioned explicitly in their policies, it is actually the defining cord of the people in power in all of these spaces. And why we can't look at caste diversity in policy is simply a thing of just, you know, oh yeah, let's just hire this one Dalit person. You can't hire a Dalit staff member into a casteist environment and not set them up to fail. And that's why, Benson, I'm just wondering, like, can you speak to what is the visionary option right now? And how do you stay resilient in this moment?
As I said, like, I think I would want to continue doing work which changes this paradigm and how we understand policy. Like, you know, it's not the outcomes are important, but like what is societal structure we are pushing these outcomes into? These are the questions we need to ask. And that is something I wanted to, or like I want my colleagues, like, you know, Dalit, Bahujan, Adivasi, and even like Savarnas, like, you know, the well-meaning Savarnas who want to do all this change, I want them to think in this dimension, like instead of invisibilizing caste or like talking in terms of, oh, marginalized people. According to like a 2016 World Bank poverty profile of India, 40% of scheduled tribes are poor and almost like 30% of scheduled castes are below the poverty line and 20% of obeses are below poverty line. And others, only 12% of others fall under that definition. So these are the things we need to keep in mind when we make our policies, right? Because even like well-meaning folks, when they put out policies, they are good recommendations in a vacuum, but society doesn't work in a vacuum. Society doesn't like, you know, operate in a single dimension or like, you know, your, the experiments, the policy experiments, the randomized control tests you run, they do not always take all these social factors into consideration. So your policy will, like, you know, even when it sounds great, the outcomes might not be the same. Or even the outcomes you envision, you put out, might not be the outcomes what the most vulnerable want. And as for like, you know, how do we stay resilient? For me, I always think about like, you know, what is the underpinning for all the struggles we're having, or what are we trying to fight? Like that is something very important. And for me, when I think of that, the term I think is like dignity. Like a good example I can think of is like my father's village. He's from like this in the Godavari Delta Basin in Andhra Pradesh. And even today, like in most of the villages in that area, you know, they are like neatly segregated. There'll be an Ambedkar statue after which it is the Dalit colonies. It used to be called as Malapalli Madigudam by the name of the caste, but now, you know, in terms of like, you know, being a little more dignified, they've called them Ambedkar colonies. And the upper caste live on the other side of the village, even today. And I remember like they were reconstructing this church in that village. And my dad wanted that they include like a community center. I mean, being this whole policy person. And I was like, why do you want them to like, I know, waste money on a community center? Why don't you like ask them to invest the money in building like a school or a primary healthcare center? And he immediately responded with like, you know, in that village, when people get married, Dalits get married, everybody sits on the road, they sweep the roads and the children sit on the road, and that is where the food is served. There's a shelter where they put all the buffaloes, and the buffaloes are sent out, they clean the shelter, and that's where the adults sit and eat. And he was like, my people should not be sitting on the floor and dust should not be falling in their food on such a special day. For him, it was the sense of dignity, wanting to have that. And that is the reason why he envisioned, like, while I was envisioning that they need a school, he envisioned that they need a community center. So I always think about, like, you know, what is it, like, the underpinnings of the things which we're fighting for? And dignity always stands out. Like, you know, this whole, like, reason to be, like, have a decent, dignified life is what we had, all these challenges are. And how do we get there? We have to be consistent. We have to be consistent in our approach and think about incremental change. We have to go all strategies. We can't, like, you know, yes, we want a revolutionary change, but in the current system, it may or may not happen. So we will have to, like, you know, look for incremental changes as well. And you have to be consistently talking about these issues, and such consistency will have consequences. You might lose friends and you might lose you know, people around your side. This happens to me all the time. Like, you know, when I ask even my peers in the diaspora, I've asked, like, even at Columbia, when I ask them the tough questions, they don't want to answer. They are willing to speak about caste from a distance as it's something that is happening everywhere, but they're not participants to it in upholding that structure. So, but when you're consistently, like, you know, talking about the caste or like how it factors into the many myriad small ways in which it plays out, then there will be consequences. But consistency is important. Again, like, same thing. This is something I learned from my own parents. Like, my mom used to work in this place called Paderu. Paderu is like it's a tribal hamlet, and like it's now a little bigger place, but it was a small town. It's in the hills in Andhra Pradesh, and she worked for many years there, and then she came back. And I used to go visit her. Like, I remember, like, talking to this Adivasi older woman, asking her, like, Amma, like, you know, they're talking about development. What is it? Do you want develop? Like, you know, do you want to, like, give your land and, like, you know, think about development? And this older lady, like Adivasi lady, told me something which really made me think a lot. She was like, this development that you're asking, because you folks have don't know how to live your life and you don't have opportunity. I can live on this land, I can farm this land, I can live here, but it's just because you people in the cities, you who are wealthy, you are not, it's not sufficient for you. Now you want our land. So that is why I always think about this, how are we thinking about development? How can we consistently think about development, and what is the what is the ripple effect of the policies we are thinking about? And those thoughts keep me resilient. And lastly, I think I'm always connected to what my background is, where I come from. And it's actually I have no option but to be connected. My mother is a doctor, but her brother is a truck driver. Her younger brother is a bus driver. I have aunts, uncles who have worked as construction labor. I have aunts who work as house helps. I have my own cousins who are working as plumbers, fitters, carpenters. And here I am in an Ivy League. So the social bubbles I exist here and the social bubbles I have in my family, when I go between them, it is they never come close. And my challenge has always been, how do I bring these social bubbles closer?
Thank you so much, Benson. I think it was great to learn from you all of those kind of not just the policy points, but personal stories. And I really want to hold up your thoughts about the requirement for dignity. And what I'm hearing from you is that, what needs to be built into policy considerations is not just kind of vague ideas of upliftment from poverty, but really kind of honest assessment about the realities of a caste society and policies that can provide people with dignity.
Yep.
So as we kind of pursue this kind of policies with dignity, what in your opinion are things that schools in America, which are responsible for the putting out many of these policy people, what can they do to better support students from caste oppressed backgrounds and also have a more inclusive and real vision for the South Asian ideas of development?
When I think of SEPA, this is a running joke. For example, we just really did a recently, all the politics, the protests going on in the US after the George Floyd Black Lives protests and the Black Lives Matters movement, we at SEPA, we have been doing an audit of how do we diversify the school? And one thing, because for example, all these public policy places, or even these top universities, they brand themselves as these very international schools. We have 60% international or different languages in their on the website and their marketing material, and which is true, but international doesn't translate to diversity. You can have a lot of white people or people who come from a similar power structure from another country. So how is that diverse, right? Even within American context, in a program of about 500 students, we have maybe 8 to 12 black students. And if you took internationally, India is one of the biggest contingents of students who come from India. And there's one Dalit student. And I think I know one OBC student. And, we have a huge contingent from Brazil, but I have not seen any, Afro-Latinos. I have not seen indigenous folks in my program. So one has to think about, this holistic structure, how diversity is not just merely international, but who are the marginalized people in these respective countries or in these communities? And public policy schools who become these pipelines for, let's say, the UN or the World Banks and other spaces which influence change, which influence the politics and the policies in their respective countries, it is upon them to think these questions of diversity much deeper, not just merely trying to have a lot of people who are from different nationalities and ethnicities.
And I think that, what it really starts for me is that, first of all of these programs need to add caste as a protected category. If they've done that work, it actually helps them better understand the axis within which they need to address caste in their diversity programs, in their recruitment for both faculty and students. But I also think, and this is getting to kind of the heart of what you're talking about, is that I guarantee you, if you talk to any of those people that have come out of these programs, they will talk your ear about how much they need to decolonize. And yep. They can talk about Homi Bhabha or, any one of the other post-colonial thinkers, but they will never have the same level of self-reflection about how Brahminical hegemony operates very much the same as colonial hegemonies.
Absolutely.
And that to me is really the core of what you're saying, is that if we don't diversify who gets to shape and be the architects of policy for the next generation of Indians, we will actually see Brahminical hegemonies continue all the way down the line. And so people who are in these sectors, whether it's development or philanthropy or, you know, other sorts of governmental policies, if they are deeply committed to the conversations of equity and poverty upliftment, they need to actually behave differently. They need to change differently. And they need to be able to not look at, oh, we're diverse because we have one Dalit on the team. We need to talk about, like, we now have Dalit supervisors. We now have Adivasi supervisors. Or, oh, look, you know, for the next like 5 years, we're going to have every program officer that's hired from this program only be Dalit, Bahujan, and Adivasi. Think how much would change structurally if that happened. And even at the core level of the faculty of these programs, and also how the conversations about what need is shaped. If we had core equity at the table, the entire understandings of why our region faces underdevelopment would absolutely shift. And I think, Benson, that's really, you know, I think some of the promise of your work and some of the colleagues that you are building with is that really building that next generation of Dalit Bahujans who can create those interventions. And so I'm just wondering if you have any last words for our audience, you know, because you've had a full range of thoughts that you kind of brought to our listeners to think about. But, you know, policy is not usually something most people get visibility on. It's kind of like the, you know, we're pulling behind the curtain behind the wizard, right? And so I'm just wanting to see what last thoughts you have, you know, particularly as we're opening up a new area of conversation for many folks that they may have not even thought that CAST operates in.
Yeah, I mean, one of the questions people ask me, like I've had like colleagues ask me, I have like, you know, folks, you know, developmental economists ask me, like, you know, what should we do, like, you know, to change this? And like, you know, it's interesting, like, I remember at one time somebody was saying, like, hey, if I drop my last name, does it help? I will tell them, drop your privilege and drop it till it hurts. Because, you know, you'll drop your last name now, but when it, you don't have to anymore. So that is how this whole system is set up, and it works in the sense, like, make way for people from Dalit, Bahujan, Adivasi communities into these spaces. And it's a long and difficult route because this is the fact of it. Tuition is a gatekeeper, and like not many people from our communities can afford to be in these places in the first place. And in these intellectual spaces and everything, they are shut out because we do not have the financial capital to be in these places. So make way, sponsor, or like, you know, create these scholarships or funding for students from these backgrounds to be in these spaces. Make way for your research to support such kind of work. If you keep researching about like the same things in terms of like, oh, only like 47% are in private schools, but think about the other people. Incorporate this into your research so that there is enough research. Like, you know, a lot of things I speak about, it's interesting. Like, you know, a lot of things I know from my lived experience, what I see in my relatives, my families, and my friends. And I come back when I do like a structured research design, the numbers just, yeah, comes back to populate and like support what I've just said. All of this I just know because of my lived experience. And because of that, I ask these questions. Most folks, they don't ask these questions because that is not their experience or that is not how they see the world. So I urge my, you know, colleagues, like, you know, in the policy space, make way for more people from Dalit, Bahujan, Adivasi communities to be here. Like, you know, and when I say make way, one is like, you know, hire them to like, you know, create opportunities to build a pipeline to be in these spaces, help them to build their experience. When you talk about caste from the upper caste, like, you know, lens of like what is happening in your own household. Instead of saying like, oh, you know, just the caste violence, why don't you talk about how upper caste, like in their, like, you know, normalized, because to, like, you know, we only know about like Karam Chedu or, you know, Sunduru, or we hear about like Rohit Vemula. This is the extreme, like, way in which caste has manifested, where lives were lost and blood was spilled. But like, you know, caste is normalized in your day-to-day interactions. You can have a diversity audit in your function, in your office. You can write these brilliant papers. But if you go home and, you know, you don't allow the people who work, you use separate utensils for the people who work in your home, or, you know, you don't have respect for the people who, you have a separate bunch of people who clean your toilets or pick up your trash, then all of this won't work. So you got to make this personal at some level.
Yes, definitely. And I think that's really the call to action. And so I think we will leave Benson with the last word of, you know, we don't want people to just drop their last names. We want them to drop their privilege till it hurts. Thank you, Benson, for just giving us those really wise words and a lot to think about and chew as we look at creating a more diverse approach to policy and development. So thank you again for joining us, Benson, and thank you all who joined us online. And we look forward to talking with you all in the next episode. JBeam, everyone.